right, wake up. That's Funkadelic from America Eats Its Young. Wake up. Live in the presence of the future. I'm Michael Slate, and this is Beneath the Surface with Michael Slate. Really happy to welcome you to the show today. Later on in the show, we'll be talking with Chris Strachwitz from the Arhuli Foundation and Arhuli Records, and it's about a collection, the largest single collection of Mexican and Mexican-American frontera music in the world, has been digitized and is now resting, and hopefully not resting that much, but at UCLA, at the Chicano Studies Research Center. And we're going to be talking with Chris about that music, about the effort to get that collection, people have access to it. We're also scheduled to talk with Gareth Porter, journalist Gareth Porter, about what's been going on with Iran and the whole dispute around nuclear weapons and the lies that have been used to actually justify, including some of these reports that have been used to justify the attack on Iran. And we're having a little bit of trouble reaching Gareth, but we will continue to try. Until then, I'm really happy to welcome back to the show after some time is Larry Everest. He's a journalist with Revolution Newspaper. He's also the author of Oil, Power, and Empire, Iraq, and the U.S. Global Agenda. And Larry's been writing a lot, both on Iran and on Afghanistan. And I wanted to talk to him today about Afghanistan. Larry, welcome to the show.
Hey, Michael. Good to be with you.
Here's the situation. We're 8 years into the war now. We're looking at what's going on. It seems there's a tremendous amount of arguing that's burst out. We've gone from the rah-rahism, the really bellicose speech at the Democratic National Convention given by Obama, the idea that it was going to be almost sort of an, if not a cakewalk, at least they were going to drive a bulldozer through and settle things once and for all. Now we're looking at some things where it's not that evident that that's the way it's going to go. In fact, there's a lot of bickering and disputes that have been going on in relation to that. There's the generals talking about what they're going to do, and there's the Obama administration, different officials in there talking about the generals better keep their opinions to themselves. And then there's all kinds of back and forth going on. And the kind of bickering and arguing that's broken out is really a whole different scene, I think, in relation to all this these days. So you've written an article called, and I think it's actually a fascinating article. It's on Afghanistan, the immorality of supporting imperialist war for promises of safety, or how 8 years of unjust war have strengthened the Taliban. And you make the point in here, after 8 years, during which U.S. claimed it was bringing democracy and liberation to Afghanistan, what has happened is the occupiers and their client regime are more widely despised than ever, and the Taliban is stronger than ever. Why? What happened?
Well, first, Michael, I think that people should. There's a tendency to, when these debates come up, to forget about history and to forget about what's happened and sort of buy into whichever argument the ruling class is putting forward at any given point. But looking at these 8 years and thinking about it is really stunning, because the Taliban is a reactionary force. It was widely hated in Afghanistan for its medieval sort of theocracy that it set up, that including the stadium stoning of women who didn't wear the veil or were accused of various violations of Islamic strictures. It was a nightmare, and the Taliban was fairly quickly overthrown in October 2001, 8 years ago, when the U.S. forces went in. But the United States, despite promises of liberation and Laura Bush saying the United States was going in to liberate women, the war in Afghanistan was conceived from the beginning as part of an overall war of greater empire. It wasn't conceived by a different group of people or at a different time than the Iraq invasion, and they even had plans for regime change in Iran. It was conceived as a multi-country, multifaceted global war to defeat Islamic fundamentalism, but also to restructure this entire Middle East, Central Asian region of the world and put it more firmly under the control of U.S. imperialism and strengthened its integration into U.S. imperialism and global capitalism, and use this control of this region to prevent rivals like Russia and China from rising. That was the actual agenda. And when the United States implemented that kind of agenda, it did not mean going into a place like Afghanistan and uprooting the very horrific feudal and religious and economic relations, both capitalist and feudal relations, that have made Afghanistan one of the most impoverished countries in the world and enforced just terrible suffering on the people of Afghanistan. Instead, the United States immediately went in, and what did they do? They allied with people like the Northern Alliance and other warlords, tribal chiefs, militia heads, landed and propertied elements, including somebody like General Dostum, who was infamous for stuffing 2,000 suspected Taliban fighters into boxcars, letting them suffocate to death, and then just dumping them in the desert. Dostum has a long record, including assassinating Afghan Maoists and other forces opposed to what he was going to do. These were the people the United States quickly cobbled into a government. One reason is the United States, as a matter of course, relies on these sorts of reactionary forces when they go in. But there was a particular necessity to do so in the case of Afghanistan because Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld had this regional vision in mind. They wanted to get this over with quickly, move on quickly to Iraq, which they viewed as the real prize in the region. So all the more reason to go with a force that already existed, that already controlled a certain amount of territory, that already had militias, and try to cobble together this government. Well, what has happened over these 8 years is this government has acted as such forces do. There's massive exploitation. That hasn't been done away with. The peasants and small farmers in Afghanistan have not been liberated from their subordination either to landlords or even to tribal chiefs, to traditional relations, to backward forms of production. Corruption, certainly, it's not even really sort of correct to maybe call it corruption. It's more just a way of doing business in which these property upper class landed elements are in control of how wealth and aid and everything else is distributed, and they use that to fortify their position. The treatment of women hasn't fundamentally been changed. There have been certain laws passed, but overall, the situation for women is still a nightmare. So you have this so-called new government, and conditions in Afghanistan have remained a nightmare. 80% of Afghan women suffer domestic violence. Honor killings and rapes are on the rise. Most women in Afghanistan are under control of their male relatives. An Afghan woman dies in childbirth every 30 minutes. This is the kind of life. And then on top of that, you have this very horrific war being waged in which the United States, certainly the Taliban has killed many civilians, no doubt about it, and the United States has as well with these aerial bombings. Recently near Kunduz, which is in northern Afghanistan, 500 people in a village had come out because a couple of tanker trucks got stuck in the mud, and there was the prospect of having fuel, just getting free fuel, and people are so destitute. Remember, the average Afghan earns less than a dollar a day. 42% of Afghans live on less than $14 a month. I mean, this is staggering poverty. So they came out to get this gasoline, and, you know, two U.S. bombers blew up these tankers. And so there's a fireball that consumes nearly 100 people, including 60 children.
So this kind of impact, this is the point about it's actually strengthening the Taliban and the hatred for what the U.S. has brought to this area. And you can see this thing in terms of explaining this point you made about both of these things being the occupiers and their puppets being hated more than ever and the Taliban being stronger than ever is rooted exactly in the way that the war has been going. But here's a question for you. And I think it's important to jump into this to some extent. And actually, I'd like to know, will you be able to stay for probably about a half an hour? Because I think we're having a lot of trouble getting hold of Gareth.
Michael,
I don't know what happened.
Michael, I will stay as long as you like. I'm like the guest that would not
leave. I know. You know, I was thinking, yeah, it'd be really difficult to get rid of you. So I'll just keep you on. Let me remind listeners that I'm Michael Slate, and this is Beneath the Surface with Michael Slate. And I'm talking today with Larry Everest, who's a journalist with Revolution Newspaper and the author of Oil, Power, and Empire, Iraq, and the U.S. Global Agenda. And we're talking about the U.S. war in Afghanistan. We're going to take a short break and come right back to rejoin our discussion with Larry Everest.
Gathered in their masses, just like witches at black masses. Evil minds that plot destruction, sorcerer of death's construction. In the fields of bodies burning, machine keeps turning.
That was Black Sabbath with War Pigs, just a song you never get tired of, and one that always seems to be appropriate, or more so these days, as things keep going on in Afghanistan, the threats against Iran. You're listening to Beneath the Surface with Michael Slate, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. We're rejoining our discussion with Larry Everest, a journalist with Revolution Newspaper. Now, Larry, clearly things are just not going the way that they wanted them to go. And you have this McChrystal, General McChrystal, who's arguing all these things about when Obama said that this was the good war and that this was a must-win war. And his thing is leaning towards, along with the neocons, leaning towards agreement with that, and that you have to pursue things in a certain way, including calling for almost 60,000 troops to be added. And then you have others who are saying, no, 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 we have to be very careful about this. And it seems like that there's even the idea of there's a little bit of looking into a really troubling at best future for the U.S. imperialists. I think, is this right or wrong? Is that there may be people thinking among them that this is not going to be all that easy, and we actually might face something we didn't think we were going to face, which is defeat.
Well, I think that's definitely, they're staring into the abyss. I mean, McChrystal's report says that the situation overall is deteriorating, and he himself warns of possible failure. Now, look, all of these things you have to take with a grain of salt. I mean, there's truth being spoken in these different reports, but there's also political truth. In other words, sometimes they're shaping the story in a way to get the particular objective they want. So we need to subject all of these ruling class reports and statements to analysis. But nonetheless, I think it's probably overall accurate when McChrystal says the situation is deteriorating from the standpoint of U.S. imperialism, and there's a possibility of failure. The Taliban is resilient and growing, he says. The U.S. and the Afghan government face a crisis of confidence. And let's recall there's just been massive election fraud on the part of the U.S. hand-picked Karzai government. So I even saw one report on NBC that said the Taliban are thought to be active in 80% of the country, stronger than they even were when they governed in October 2001. And that goes to your first point, and we should just keep constantly in mind, is how the clash between imperialism and Islamic fundamentalism is a real clash. But at the same time, these two reactionary poles actually reinforce and strengthen each other. There's a dynamic here that you can see over these 8 years. And of course, perpetuating this war is going to perpetuate that reactionary dynamic. And what we were just talking about, you see your children blown up in front of you. What are people going to do? They're going to turn to somebody that's opposing this, even if they don't particularly like them. And that's a lot of what we've seen. But in terms of the debate, I think that the U.S. is faced with a very acute situation. Peggy Noonan, who is a former Reagan speechwriter, was writing about this in the Wall Street Journal. And her argument is it's the hell of withdrawal versus the hell of staying. And she says nobody is certain to what to do. This isn't an obvious choice, a no-brainer, or obviously a stupid option. There are no good options here. And it is not only because the United States finds itself in this spiraling dynamic in which the more military force they have tried to apply, the more it has destabilized and strengthened the Taliban, and also spread the chaos and the destabilization into Pakistan, which is a much bigger country. But all this is going on at a very precarious moment when the U.S. military is overstretched. There's still 130,000 troops in Iraq. The U.S. has been fighting these wars for 8 years. There are now close to 70,000 U.S. troops in Afghanistan. There's just been the greatest financial crisis in U.S. history. There are other powers that are gaining ground in the world, and they're not, you know, there's not a frontal challenge to the U.S. position, but there are certainly growing rivalry, China and Russia, and then even, of course, all the difficulties with Iran. So this is an extremely difficult situation, and they're basically debating. I mean, McChrystal has reportedly asked for up to 80,000 more troops. I mean, that's a huge commitment, because his argument is that if you don't pacify certain areas and win the support of or at least have people accept your rule and prevent the Taliban from overthrowing the regime, if you don't do that, there's going to be chaos that could both destabilize the whole region and also lead to a retreat or a defeat by the U.S., which would have enormous global repercussions, because these global imperialist superpowers, I mean, it is, it's like the mafia. If you show weakness, you're finished. A lot of the power of the United States comes from the perception and the reality that it's got a huge military, that it's willing to use it. And if it's seen that it can be defeated in a place like Afghanistan, that weakens its so-called street cred, if you want to use that language, all around the world. The other thing that's of great concern to these people is Islamic fundamentalism in all its different forms. And right now, there's a debate. Is Al-Qaeda the same as the Taliban? And what are the different elements of this? But nonetheless, there is a broad Islamic fundamentalist trend that's been rising across the Middle East, largely in reaction to the depredations and the massive dislocations caused by imperialism. And this fundamentalism, it doesn't offer any sort of path to liberation whatsoever. It represents the outmoded and traditional social forces and classes in these oppressed countries. But it has created a problem for the United States.
There is a relationship here in terms of what you're talking about. There's what the imperialists are dealing with. And then there's the question that's become a very big question once again. It was at one point it reared its head in the beginning of the Iraq War when people were arguing for immediate withdrawal, and various social democrats and people in the left wing of the Democratic Party were arguing for responsible withdrawal. And now today you have this kind of situation that you're describing, but you also have people who have been pretty much opposed to the war all the way through and who have been speaking out and doing some good things in terms of opposition and resistance, although, you know, they've come at it from different angles. But now people like Medea Benjamin, she's come back from Afghanistan and arguing that actually we need a responsible withdrawal from Afghanistan. There is no other choice that would be at all meaningful for the people of Afghanistan in any good way except to have a responsible withdrawal. What do you say to something like that?
Well, it's an important question. A lot of people feel this way. I will give the short, snappy answer, and I'll be channeling Craig Murray, the former British ambassador, when someone asked him how he thought the U.S. should leave Iraq, and he said preferably on airplanes. And it was sort of a snappy response, but it had real meaning. In other words, what what needs to happen is the U.S. needs to leave, because as long as the United States stays in Iraq or in Afghanistan, it is going to be pursuing imperialist objectives. It is not going to be doing what Code Pink or other progressive or radical people want it to do. It is going to be pursuing its global imperialist agenda. It is going to be trying to strengthen the relations of domination in the countries that it is involved in. And A, that's a nightmare for the people there. B, it fuels Islamic fundamentalism and deepens this spiral. We need to break out of this situation where people feel their only choices are picking one or the other of these reactionary forces. And number three, any argument that argues that there's some validity to U.S. occupation in whatever form it is legitimizing other occupations. I often think that, for example, the attack and the occupation of the former Yugoslavia in the 90s in the name of humanitarian relief, and there were crimes being committed, no doubt, but this helped pave the way for the invasion of Iraq in the name of and of Afghanistan, freeing the people. So for all those reasons, the responsible thing is to demand the U.S. leave immediately. And
look, people are going to come back to you and they're going to say, look, all the horror that you just described, all the things that have been unleashed in the course of the last 8 years, and most of them under the Bush administration, and most of them in a kick-ass and forget about, you know, collecting names, just go through the country and rip it up until you can basically declare victory. They'll say all those things have been unleashed, and people will make an argument that there has to be some way for some force, something, to come in and modify or moderate what the U.S. does, to turn their occupation force into something other than what it is. And I mean, people will argue that even with you saying, look, this is what they've done. Well, people know what they've done. But then the question of what can they be made to do that will at least give the people of Afghanistan a position to move off of?
Well, I think we have to do two things. One, and this is something World Can't Wait has been stressing, we need mass political resistance in this country against these wars of empire, against the torture and so on, and break through this suffocating silence that exists. And if this happens in this country, this is one contribution toward creating a different way, an alternative to either of these other two, to create more political space for this. The other thing I think is important is supporting revolutionary and radical secular forces from places like Afghanistan and Iran, who want neither imperialism nor the Taliban and Islamic fundamentalism. That's also, that is the alternative for the people of Afghanistan, including revolutionary communist forces who see that you need to thoroughly break out of the hold of feudalism and imperialism, and that you need to overthrow those two mountains to really liberate the people. Those are the kinds of things that we need to be working at. Yes, they're very difficult. It's not some immediate and easy kind of a solution, but we've seen in 8 years, think about this, in the last 6 months or so, the United States has changed its tactics to basically what Code Pink called for, doing more training of Afghan troops, trying to promote economic development, facilitating reconciliation. And in this case, what that really means is reconciliation between the Taliban and the Karzai reactionaries, and doing it in a way that prevents the return of the Taliban. Well, that's a thumbnail sketch of a lot of, and I'm not cheap shot here, but that is a lot of what the U.S. is trying to do. But it's doing it on the basis of being an occupying imperialist army, A, and B, those actions, as we've been talking. Look, at here's one example. Yesterday, there was an article in the New York Times saying civilian goals, these goals of economic reconstruction and so on, have not been met. And there was a stunning statistic. The U.S. has given $13 billion to Afghanistan. The ministry responsible can't account for any of it. Why is that? Because even if the U.S. is giving aid, it's being mediated by, it's going through, A, what the objectives of the U.S. are, and B, this whole ruling structure in Afghanistan, which is using whatever money they get to aside from the graft and corruption and all that, to reinforce their dominant oppressive position within the country, not to liberate the people. So you get a situation in which people are turning in frustration to the Taliban because at least there's some administrative procedures that they've put in place, whereas the central government's not able to dispense doesn't have any kind of legal or court system that people can turn to. So that's the situation. And as long as the U.S. is there, that situation is going to deepen and worsen. Look, you could make the same argument 7 years ago and say the U.S. shouldn't withdraw from Afghanistan because, after all, wouldn't that be irresponsible? And I do want to say, Medea, Code Pink, and other groups are raising, doesn't the U.S. have an obligation to Afghanistan? Yes, the U.S. has a tremendous debt to Afghanistan, but the way for people in this country to carry forward our responsibility is to fight to politically and ideologically prevent this empire from carrying out these kind of crimes.
On that note, we're going to have to wrap it up. And I think that's a very important point to end on, because that's actually, when you look at what's going on in the world today, when you look at what's going on in response to the kind of horrors that have been unleashed, the hell in Afghanistan is the hell for the people of Afghanistan. That's really what's been left out of all this. And what you've been talking about, it has been really pointing to that. And I think the idea that the people here and the people of the world, the responsibility we have to the people of Afghanistan is doing exactly what you're saying, doing everything that can be done to oppose that, you know, to oppose what imperialism is doing there. Larry, thank you very much for joining us today.
Hey, thanks a lot, Michael. Sure. Take care.
Thank you. You too. You're listening to Beneath the Surface with Michael Slate, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. We've been talking with Larry Everest, a journalist with Revolution Newspaper, about the U.S. war against Afghanistan and all the contradictions that are jumping up around that. We're going to take a short break and come right back to join Chris Strachwitz from the Arhuli Foundation talking about the world's largest collection of Mexican and Mexican-American commercially recorded music that now sits in the UCLA Library, its online archive. We'll be right back. Now that was a greasy song. That's from Dr. Lonnie Smith. It's called And the World Weeps, and it's from his album Rise Up. You're listening to Beneath the Surface with Michael Slate, and I'm Michael Slate. And now we're going to be speaking with, this is a conversation I've been waiting to have for quite some time. We're going to be speaking with Chris Strachwitz, who's the head of Arhuli Records, the Arhuli Foundation. And he's also one of the coolest people I've ever heard of. Chris, welcome to the show.
No, thanks for having me.
Sure. And I said that you're one of the coolest people I've ever heard of because what I've read about you and your devotion to bringing music, the music of of the people who, you know, a lot of people, what they may say are marginalized voices, but the people who actually are on the living on the bottom of society in a lot, in many instances, but bringing the music and the culture of those people to the broadest possible accessibility. And I've just been really astounded, including the fact that for people, and a lot of people, I don't know if people know this very well, but including the fact that you actually recorded the original version of Feel Like I'm Fixing to Die Rag with Country Joe. And that right there, you had me right there, man.
That was just a lucky accident.
Okay. Well, one of the things that I wanted to talk to you about, and this is something that happened last March, the end of last March, and it's been a hell of an effort on my part to try and, you know, get the time and get the and be able to squeeze this in. And I figured at this point I really wanted to just spend some time talking with you about this because it's so damn important. The UCLA's Chicano Studies Research Center basically now has the world's top online archive of Mexican-American recordings. This is a Mexican-American music. And you are responsible for that happening. You've basically donated your Frontera collection, which is the largest in the world. And I understand even that's including even in Mexico. There's no place that has a larger collection of this type of music than you, right?
I think that's probably correct, especially because my focus in the Frontera collection is entirely on the basically on border music, on what was recorded in the area between the U.S. and northern Mexico, primarily on our side of it, and therefore dealing with the real vernacular.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about this, because first give people a sense of when we say that there's this online archive, what is it that they would find if they went there?
Well, you can certainly find the 17,078 RPM records that are in my collection called the Frontera Collection. And that was done and is available, however, only for 60 seconds of each of them, unless you go there and then you can hear the entire selection. This is due to our copyright laws, because these are commercial records, and UCLA, being a state institution, cannot try and circumvent the possibility of problems there. So it all happened because the late Professor Guillermo Hernandez, who was the first one to be in charge of the Chicano Studies Department at UCLA, he became a good friend of ours when we were editing the film that I did with Les Blank called Chulas Fronteras back in the 70s. And he was just amazed at this material that was recorded, because he couldn't believe it, especially, let's say, in San Antonio, in the late 20s and early 30s, a lot of two-sided corridos. These are the narrative ballads that Mexicans have been composing and singing for way over a century. And so he became absolutely enamored by it. And, of course, he wanted the collection for UCLA. And I said, well, no, as long as I'm alive, I don't want them to sit there in some dusty corner. And so by that time, in the, I guess, in the 90s it happened, that my attorney told me, I mean, due to Mo Ash, actually, more than anybody else, I started a foundation, and I gave the collection to the foundation, but UCLA, with the help of Los Tigres del Norte, who are the most incredible contemporary Norteño conjunto that is happening, you should really check out their new powerful protest song. I mean, if you think Country Joe did powerful protest songs, you should hear what these guys put down.
You know, I've had them on the show a couple of times, actually. They're really amazing.
Yeah. And especially Jorge Hernandez, the oldest of the brothers. But they're all just fantastic people, and they realized that this was their culture of their people. You see, they don't really write books or novels, but they write a lot of songs about everything under the sun, and a lot of about the conflict that went on in the Rio Grande Valley and in Texas, you know, between gringos and Mexicans, and continues to go on. And they wrote songs about every kind of political scenario. Of course, today the corrido has sort of degenerated into the narco corrido, because that is the only thing that is of interest to most younger immigrants, because, you know, they feel totally at a loss of ever getting anywhere. And so, just like in, anyway, I won't go into all those details. But anyway, what they will find in that collection are really the history of Mexican Americans primarily in this country and what they have been singing about.
Well, now let me ask you this. I mean, I was really moved by, I read a quote from you where you talked about this, exactly what you're saying, that this is actually, in a lot of ways, this is the literature of the people, basically, this music. And one of the things that I was really struck by is that you, and I know everybody asks you this, but I think it's important for people to get this, you're somebody who, you didn't speak much Spanish or any at all when you first were attracted to this music, and yet you've devoted your life to collecting, amassing, and really, from little short YouTube things I've seen and what I've read, you've amassed this huge, from original masters to 78s that, I mean, 78s themselves, finding them, especially in an industry, in a type of music where, as you pointed out, has actually often been marginalized in both countries, on both sides of the border, and so recordings would be made, they would disappear, companies would go out of business, but you've amassed this huge collection, and yet, one big question, why? What drove you to do that?
I just fell in love with the sound of it. When I first started driving to Texas in 1960 and on, I mean, I was born in Germany, and I was fascinated by American radio when I got here in 47 and so forth, and then when I heard Mexican music, it just absolutely grabbed me in, just like hillbilly music did, just like New Orleans jazz did, like blues did, like everything else. And when you go through Texas in those days, you couldn't help but hearing it, coming out of every beer joint and dance hall. You know, sure, there were Western bands, but I just totally fell in love with it. And I realized that hardly anyone was paying any attention to it. You know, I met a lot of record collectors over the years, collected everything, blues, Cajun, gospel, jazz, you name it, you know. But nobody paid any attention to this extraordinarily rich cultural heritage. And people helped me along the way to understand what it was all about. And I'm just totally bananas about it. That's basically what happened. And the whole thing just drove me. And then other people seemed to be fascinated by it. And especially when Los Tigres del Norte, you know, realized that this was their culture and it went back in recorded form that far back, it would just totally take them.
Wow. You know, it's amazing. If you go to a Tigres concert, it's just, you know, you see something that you just rarely see in any concert in terms of the way, both the interaction between the audience and the performers. I remember Jorge telling me how they film, they video all of the audience so they can see what songs people are reacting to, what storylines they're reacting to, and then they talk to people. I've never seen such a huge band that will stand backstage and just as thousands line up and just stop and talk to everybody, whether it's, you know, after playing 4 hours straight without a break and then they're going to stand there for a couple hours greeting people. It really is rooted. And I'd also have to say that the fact that you went bananas for this music, the world is much better for a much better place for that fact. Now, let me ask you this. Why the border? You said you concentrate on the border. And I know you mentioned this when you were at UCLA at the opening of this. You mentioned that the border, actually, there was something about the music on both sides of the border. Why that?
First of all, it's the accordion music that grabbed me, which originated in that region, both in South Texas and in northern Mexico, in Nuevo León and Tamaulipas and so on. And secondly, but primarily, it is because it is an isolated region. It's just as far from, you know, any place in the United States as it is from Mexico City. And in Mexico City, it was always considered hillbilly music. They call it, that's why it's called norteño down there. You know, they just consider it their bread and butter, just like people here considered hillbilly music back in the 20s. It was their bread and butter, but they didn't really like it, you know. And here it was considered also just the low-class music. It was the cantina music. It was the music that the beer garden, that the beer joint patrons enjoyed, you know. But it dealt with all these problems that they really dealt with, not only working in the cotton fields or in the and the melon strikes along the border, and and this constant harangue by what they call those rinchis cobardes, the cowardly rangers, the cowardly Texas Rangers, you know, always beat them up. And oh God, anyway, to me that was the real struggle. The music in Mexico, you see, the vernacular, the real low class, didn't really sell on records because people were simply too poor in Mexico per se. So the Mexican record companies, until the 40s, didn't really deal in this music or recorded it. But here on the border, it was recorded beginning in the 20s. And because there were people here who were making money, you know, they were working in the fields or in construction or whatever ever since day one, just as they are today, but they could afford to spend money on recordings. And so this regional music, this regional production thrived.
Well, let's take a listen to Mal Hombre, Lydia Mendoza, and then we'll come back for a few minutes and talk about that.
Well, she was one of the great ladies of song, and she was a young girl when she made this. She was, I think, 18 years old, and she played her own 12-string guitar.
Wow. Well, let's take a listen, and then we'll talk about that a little bit, and then there's another one I want to play you know, later on. So let's take a listen to Lydia Mendoza with Mal Hombre. Just beautiful. What a tremendous and amazing voice and amazing sound. Tell us a little bit about Lydia Mendoza and that song, Chris.
God, well, it's a song that obviously grabbed her. She had it on a little gum wrapper. Apparently, it was made popular by a woman named Elisa Baruman in the late 20s. It's strange that there was no publisher, no composer listed. Yet, Lydia had been collecting as a young child these gum wrappers that would have songs printed on them. And when her father took her to a theater in Monterrey, Nuevo León, one day, she heard the singer sing this song. And she said, oh, my God, here it is. And she finally knew how the melody went. And it is a powerful song, how men are just evil, how they are really, you know, how they mistreat women. And it to my opinion, to most people, it originated probably in Argentina in the red light district in Buenos Aires or someplace, you know, because it is a tango. And for that reason, anyway, it obviously grabbed her, you know. And so she just blew them out of the pond with her version. The earlier version we also have in the collection by Elisa Baruman, but it isn't done in the vernacular like Lydia. You see, Lydia, you can see, she sang like the Carter family. Elisa Baruman was more of the theatrical entertainer who was a good soprano, you know.
That's really fascinating. You have that aspect in terms of the social and personal relations. And then you have this next song, which I just want people to get a sense of, which is Gregorio Cortez. And I want to play a couple minutes from that and then have you talk about that, because there's another aspect of the collection you have.
Quedando Román herido. Otro día por la mañana, cuando la gente llegó, unos a los otros dicen, no saben quién lo mató. Se anduvieron informando como tres horas después. Supieron que el malhechor era Gregorio Cortés.
Gregorio Cortez. Chris, tell us about this one.
Yeah, that's one of those powerful border conflict corridos that happened in 1910, I believe. They even made a movie about it. You probably heard about it.
Yes.
It was pretty good. But it is still sung today, and it has never died. I was just amazed. Like, for example, in the 70s, I remember fellow record producer from Sweden was visiting me here, and I took him to San Francisco to a Mexican bar in San Francisco, and the second number that Conjunto played was Gregorio Cortez. I mean, and these songs live on because they deal with this conflict between between Anglos and Mexicans. This one happened over a linguistic misunderstanding primarily, and anyway, these are powerful songs, you know.
Very, very much so. Now, let me remind listeners that you're listening to Beneath the Surface with Michael Slate. I'm Michael Slate, and I'm talking now with Chris Strachwitz, who's the head of our Huli Records and our Huli Foundation, and he has been one of the moving forces. His collection, the largest collection of Mexican-American recordings, Frontera collection, I'll get my voice back soon, a Frontera collection that is now online. It's an online archive, the world's top online archive of Mexican-American recordings at UCLA. And you can access this at frontera.library.ucla.edu. Again, frontera.library.ucla.edu. Now, Chris, when you talk about these border conflicts, and there's a universality, and as I was going through the catalog there, and I was then you know, just looking around and some of the music that I have at home, and realizing seeing some of the same songs being played by groups that are existent today, and there's a different spin put on it. But then I came across something, and I remember a song in particular that really grabbed me a number of years ago when it first came out, and I had no idea that you were actually also the moving force behind this song, which is El Corrido de Ezequiel Hernandez.
Oh, that's one about Ezequiel Hernandez. And yeah, that was one of those tragic things where this young fellow got killed by U.S. Marines just across on this side of the border near Presidio, Texas. And it was during a time when we had armed troops along the border, you know, in this insane drug war, as if they can ever fight it. And I asked Santiago Jimenez basically to write a corrido about it. And it just got to me. Also, well, it's a long story behind it. But if any of your audience are interested, you know, many of these items are actually available on records that we have reissued on our Huli, or have actually originally issued on our Huli. And they can easily find that. Our website is fronteracollection.com. FronteraCollection.com.
Oh, great. Okay, I'll be there tonight. Okay,
that'll take you to all we have on our Huli in regard to this material.
Great, and we're going to play Ezequiel Hernandez as we go out. But then we still have a few more minutes. So one of the reasons I wanted to refer to that was there's a point here around, like I was saying, the universality and the fact that even though the collection at UCLA concentrates at this point up to about the 1950s, is that correct?
We have completed all of the 78s, which go into the mid-50s, but we're now almost a third into the 45s, and there are about 25,000 of those.
Wow. Wow. I got to come up and hang out with you, man.
So they're alphabetically by label. We have all of the Colonial, all of the ARVs, whatever, you know, ABCD. We're in the Fs now. We're in Discos Pharma right now.
Wow. Just as sort of the last point is this universality and this constant growth and development of the music. When I read this about your involvement in the Corrido de Ezequiel Hernandez, I was just astounded that to see the connection between them. Because when I heard it, you know, quite frankly, probably based on my own ignorance, it was just sort of like it was a beautiful song. I thought I was very moved by its subject matter, but it didn't strike me its deep roots in what this point you made about the culture and literature of the people, deep roots that continue to develop in a way that is very, very powerful around exactly that question, around the border, around the relationship between the two peoples and whatnot. It's just an incredible piece. So I want to remind people again, well, maybe you can tell people, do you know people can go to the Chicano Studies Research Center, or they can go to the UCLA Library or anywhere on the UCLA campus and access all of the music, right?
Yes. If they go to the UCLA Digital Library, I'm not sure exactly what building that's in.
It's a digital building. You've got to figure it out.
It must be in some basement somewhere.
Right, yeah.
and ask for the Frontera collection.
I know you can actually go online now to frontera.library.ucla.edu and only get those that 50-second sample, but you can get a sense of what's out there. I think it's really incredibly, it's just an incredibly powerful and beautiful collection.
I want to
thank you very much for putting it together, man.
Well, I'm glad I've been able to contribute something in this regard, because these were not preserved. I mean, you know, if there are copies of blues, of jazz, of Cajun music, some collector has done it someplace, but this material has never been bothered with by anyone. And there's a lot of one-of-a-kinds in there, I can tell you that.
So, Chris, I want to thank you very much for what you've done and for being on the show today.
Well, thank you for having me. And tell them to go to fronteracollection.com and they'll visit us there.
Okay, great. You've been listening to Beneath the Surface with Michael Slate. I'm Michael Slate, the host and producer of the show. I want to thank my engineer today, Ray Pizel. I want to thank my guests, Larry Everest from Revolution Newspaper and Chris Strachwitz from the Arhui Foundation and Arhui Records. And we'll also try to get Gareth Porter back at some point in the near future. And I also want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. And if you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. We are going to go out with a song I was just talking with Chris about, El Corrido de Ezequiel Hernandez. A very powerful, powerful piece of music. So listen up, you like it, pick the whole thing up, you won't regret it. Until next week, take care.
Voy a cantar un corrido, no se les vaya a olvidar. Esto pasó en Redbird, Texas. Fue muerto Ezequiel Hernández, un marín lo asesinó. Pues el que lo asesinó era el joven Clemente. Pagado a la cielo, lo llevo en mi corazón.